Relationships, not always simple, but in Guido Maze's book, The Wild Medicine Solution, we learn that the wild and green variety can be. And by following his outline for the aromatic, bitter, and tonic types of plants, any one of us can venture into our garden or into the woods nearby and enhance not only our physical health, but our renewed mystical connection. As an herbalist and educator, Guido freely draws from this interrelated web called life, a great way to walk down this path. We're here today with part two. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Are there physical properties to plants that give clues as to whether it's an aromatic, a bitter, or a tonic?
Yeah. I mean, what I talk about in the introduction to the book is that people would use taste as the chemical detection system to kind of figure out what the heck was going on with plants. And we train our herbalists here at the Herb School to still use that as a primary way of basically sidling up to the plant and starting a conversation with it to kind of get to know what it might be useful for. And we have a fancy name for it, which is called organoleptic testing, which really just means use your senses to figure out what's going on and if the plant is right. But taste is one of the first places. And so the aromatic plants, really, you know, you can taste them because you can smell them, right? So all the aromatic plants have odor to them. And the reason they have odor is because they have these volatile oils, these essential oils. And they usually taste spicy or at least enlivening or pungent or something, you know. You put peppermint in your mouth, you're going to feel that menthol. It's going to have a bite to it. You put ginger in your mouth, it's pungent. Garlic in your mouth, it's pungent. So they have this smell, but you also get this sort of almost burning pungency from them, right? Bitter plants taste really bitter. There's, you know, it's a straight one-to-one correspondence. If a plant tastes bitter, then it is a bitter. There's not really much more to it than that. You don't have to go out finding gentian root or centaury, some of the most bitter plants we know of. Anything that tastes bitter from the plant world, and most do, is going to have a little bit of a bitter action to it. And then the tonics, they're a little bit harder. I divide them in the book into two categories, the sweet tonics and the sour tonics. And sour tonics are plants that have a high proportion of somewhat astringent compounds. They would be things like berries. You know, blueberries are a little bit sweet, but really, you know, if you just eat a blueberry, the first flavor a kid would tell you it has is it's sour, right? Lots of citrate and vitamin C, but then also bioflavonoids. And these are the major chemicals that are responsible for sourness, but also responsible for the tonic action of the plant. You see it in hawthorn berries. You even see it in, like, you know, apples to a certain extent. So that's the sour tonic category. And those ones seem to be amazing for preventing cardiovascular disease and helping with our heart and blood vessels. Then there's the sweet tonics. And they start with something as simple as, you know, a brown rice congee, and it's going to taste sweet. Now, I'm not talking about sugar or sweet foods here. That's a little bit different. Wouldn't have been something that could have been found by human beings, you know, 50,000 years ago. But if you found a plant that had a root that tasted sweet, you probably were dealing with a bunch of starches, particularly polysaccharides, that might have had a little bit of a soothing quality or an ability to nourish and balance gut flora, but crucially a way to balance or talk to the immune system. So a lot of the sweet tonics, and I include mushrooms in there with herbs like ginseng and astragalus, Siberian ginseng, they're sweet because of these immune-active polysaccharide chains that taste a little bit starchy and sweet to us. And what they do is they act as tonics by helping to rebalance the way the immune system deals with everything. If the immune system is hyperactive, in the case of allergies or autoimmune disease, it can really help tone that function down a little bit. And if the immune system is underactive, you know, in the case of cancer chemotherapy or someone's been dealing with a protracted infection or they have mono or something like that, these polysaccharides from the tonics can really bump things up. So you can just, you know, taste plants from a jar in the herb store or from plants that you grow in your garden, and if they're pungent and have a strong smell, most likely they're aromatic, and they're going to work for what aromatics need to work for, which is relaxing the belly balancing the level of tension in internal organs, and in so doing, balancing the level of tension in our mind and spirit, which I think is so important for modern life. Any plant that's aromatic will do that for you. Roses, lemon balm, peppermint, ginger, garlic, you name it. If it has a strong scent and pungency to it, it's going to help in that department if you eat it. Then bitter plants, straight up bitter. Anything that tastes bitter is going to help with digestion, be it a radicchio leaf or a dandelion root. Right? It's going to help with digestive function. It's going to decrease heartburn. It's going to improve your breakdown of food, and it's going to help the liver do its job better in terms of keeping you kind of low level of toxicity as possible. And then sweet and sour tonics. Sour for the cardiovascular disease, for heart health, and sweet tonics for balancing immune function. Now, you just got to make sure that these are things that you're getting from whole plants that are relatively unhybridized, right? So, you know, potatoes, I don't know that they're going to necessarily, even though they taste kind of sweet, have a lot of immune rebalancing activity. But if it's a semi-wild, weedy plant, like astragalus root, and you pull up the root and you taste it, it's very different from a dandelion root. It's sweet, it's nourishing, it's round-tasting. That's a great way to talk to your immune system and balance out its function a little bit.
I was interested in what you were writing about with the Paracelsian alchemy. And I'm wondering if you could just speak about that a little bit. And I was wondering, do the sulfur, salt, and mercury traits of that relate to aromatics, bitters, and tonics?
That's so cool that you thought about that. I was thinking about that myself a lot. And I wasn't able to draw complete correspondence with it enough to make me feel comfortable to actually include it in the book. But I studied a lot of Paracelsian alchemy, and I'm really into the guy Paracelsus. He's kind of a wandering, mouthy, rabble-rousing drunk. And his general idea in, you know, the late 15th, early 16th century in Europe was to go around and tell the sort of ossified physicians who were trying to practice medicine from thousand-year-old books that they did really, you know, they didn't have their head in a good place, so to speak. And it was important for them to return to nature and start using plants and minerals and, like, real vital substances to cure people. So anyway, he's a great sort of counterculture figure, I think, in that late Middle Age, early Renaissance time of Europe. But he came up with the idea of taking a plant material and dividing it potentially into three parts. The mercury is sort of the vital force, and it was the spirit of it. And why did he call it spirit? Because they literally distilled spirits from plants, right, by fermenting them and turning them into beer, and then distilling that beer and making a spirit. And this sounds like a no-brainer to us. It's like, yeah, of course, you make whiskey out of mash, and that makes sense. But to them, it was really new in Europe at that time. Whiskey really hadn't existed before then. So this was, you know, this water that you could draw out of a beer, and when you set it on fire, it burned, and this is just a very magical substance. So it was considered to be the animating force, the vital force of the plant, right? And then there was the sulfur. And the sulfur, you know, if you ever get to a sulfur hot spring or you smell elemental sulfur, you know it's got a smell. It's like not the best smell, kind of rotten, eggy. But to the alchemists, sulfur was the idea of a personality or an essence that was unique to each individual plant. And Paracelsus connected it to the essential oils, the volatile components of the plant. And then finally, the salt. Salt was what you would take. You take all the plant material that you had that you'd use to distill the essential oil or you'd use to ferment it into a beer. You'd grind it up and you'd burn it down to a white ash through a process called calcination. And then that white ash would be dissolved in water, and everything that dissolved in water was the salt, and everything else that settled at the bottom was called a death's head, and they just throw that stuff out. Then you can take that water into which the salt is dissolved and evaporate it, and you're left with these feathery crystals of salt. And each of these salts, it's unique to a different plant. I encourage you to try it if you can. You can do it in a Dutch oven by putting a bunch of plant material into the Dutch oven and burning it on an outdoor hardwood fire until it's very fine white ash. And you put it in distilled water and let it settle out and then evaporate that distilled water. You'll be left with a saltiness that is totally unique to whatever plant it is you're using. And, I mean, campers know this. They use ash as a way to season food. And there's different plants that make different kinds of ashes. Some of them are saltier. Some of them are more bitter. So what was I thinking? You know, I was like, well, obviously, the sulfur is the aromatic, there's a one-to-one correspondence with that even chemically. The essential oil of the plant is the aromatic fraction of the plant. It's chemically responsible for what aromatics do for us, for our mind and for our spirit. And so maybe the sulfur in Paracelsus is the sort of the aromatic component of a plant. And I think that that's definitely true. But with the bitter and tonic, I had a bit of a harder time. I mean, tonics would be mercury, maybe, you know, the vital force, the animating force. And then salt would be bitter. Some salts are bitter, but not all salts are bitter. The place where I had a little bit of an issue was that the aromatic was considered personality, and that's like mind and spirit, and that makes total sense to me. But the animating force, the mercury, it's a little harder, I think, to directly connect that to like cardiovascular health or immune function. I mean, you could. And then the salt to sort of bitterness and body, I mean, it makes sense. The bitters are the most grounding of all the three classes of plants. They're the ones that interface with our most physical form, the GI tract, the gut. So you could say that the quote-unquote salt of Paracelsian alchemy would be connected to the bitter. But I honestly, Robin, had a hard time making the case airtight, which is why I didn't include it in the book, although I was definitely thinking about that.
Right.
And.
I think I like what you said and agree with what you just said about salt. We've been using a salt solution using Himalayan sea salts and just slowly putting it into water. And then when the salts stop dissolving, when it starts leaving a residue, you know, the salt isn't dissolving anymore, then we know our solution is complete. And then we're having people take just a teaspoon of that solution in a full glass of regular water.
Uh-huh.
And the salt contains trace elements and full-bodied minerals. And, you know, of course, using the water as a vehicle, it does really go into all aspects of the body and carries that deep message of full nutrition.
Yeah, and so I think the analogy of salt as being the most physical of the three, and then the idea of the digestive process as being the most physical, tangible connection from the three classes of plants, the aromatics, the tonics, and the bitters, I can see where that's the case. Salt is also super grounding stuff.
Yes.
For example, my wife and I, at the end of our wedding ceremony, we put a tiny pinch of salt into, I put a little tiny pinch of salt in her mouth, and she put a tiny pinch of salt into mine to kind of like bring us back into our body and say like, wow, we've just been out there in this crazy spirit love space for the last 45 minutes in this ceremony. Let's ground down. Let's come back down to earth. And salt does that in a really big way, I think. But bitter plants do as well, especially if someone is feeling, you know, really out of their body and disconnected and out in space. Munching on something bitter is a great way to kind of just to bring yourself right back into your most primal connection with the physical world, which is through your belly, right?
Right. I don't know, if you munch on something super bitter, you might go, yuck, I don't want to be here.
Yeah, or like, at least, whoa, here I am, right?
Right. Yes, I know, that's true. Speaking of the aromatics, how do they increase heart variability? And we all know that that's a key piece to good heart health.
Yeah, heart rate variability is definitely receiving a lot more attention in terms of a marker of good cardiovascular health. And the way the aromatics help with that is they seem to increase the activity along the vagus nerve, which is the sort of nerve that connects a lot of our internal organs to the brain. And so really it's like the relayer of our gut feelings, quite literally. Feelings from the gut, but also feelings from the heart and from the lungs, from all of our hollow organs. And when that stuff gets up in the brain, you know, we're not really directly conscious of our belly the same way we're conscious of, like, you know, a pin in our finger if we were to prick ourselves. But nevertheless, the signals that are coming through the vagus nerve to our brain have something to say about the internal state of tension, right? And you also get signals coming up to the brain from the heart muscle itself and from the way the heart muscle is dealing with the blood vessels through which it's pumping blood. And once the aromatic plants are absorbed from our gut into, and the other constituents are taken up into our bloodstream, what we see is that there's this reduction of spasm and relaxation and opening of the blood vessels, which the heart feels as a state of relaxation, a state of rest and digest, very different from the fight-or-flight state. The fight-or-flight state tends to constrict our peripheral vessels to protect us from bleeding should we get injured on our arms or legs, and also make sure that blood stays at the core where we need it for lung function, for heart function, and for the big muscles that we would use to flee or to fight. So it looks like the aromatics, from a physiologic perspective, in the blood vessels and in the internal organs, increase the amount of tone or signaling that's coming through the vagus nerve and going up to the brain. And that is directly an indication of how much we are in rest and digest mode as opposed to in fight or flight mode. When there's more tone coming through the vagus nerve, we are almost always more often in rest and digest mode, or we're in a meditative state, or we are just finished a big meal. The last thing that we're worried about is a predator or a fight or having to run away.
Yes.
And what people have found is that one of the reasons high rates of heart rate variability are good is because they indicate that you are in a rest and digest state. When you get into a fight or flight mode, the heart rate variability goes away. And so people who generally sit in a fight or flight state, I mean, that's what's making you more at risk, I think, for heart attacks and cardiovascular disease. And so the idea that aromatics relax the muscle, open the circulation, and get the heart into thinking that it's in a rest and digest state, that's why you get better heart rate variability, and that's also why they are more, I think, lead to cardioprotective effects.
Yes.
Interestingly, it's also why you use them to break fevers, because they open up the circulation of the periphery and help you sweat out heat in a really good way and cool yourself off.
Tell us about the Santa Maria Novella Pharmacy. I love that piece.
Yeah, that's an amazing place. So it's in Florence, and we didn't really, like, we didn't set out to find it, but we kind of knew it was there, and we really came around it randomly. And there's this small storefront, and you walk through this storefront, which is just like bottles and bottles of, you know, alchemical old amber bottles full of these remedies, mortars and pestles that are, you know, for display but contain different amounts of herbs and various states of grinding, all behind black cases, glass cases. And then you get to the counter at the end of the storefront, and behind the counter are these double doors that lead to this courtyard. And there's these, I don't know, they're very elegant. They're not like boisterous gardens full of flowers. They're just very elegant herb gardens planted in a geometric pattern inside this inner courtyard, like so many of the buildings in Italy. And Santa Maria Novella has been around, they got their certificate in the 13th century, but they were around before that. But they've been making these alchemical remedies for a long time. And the claim to fame, sort of the thing that now has reached global notoriety, is the Acqua di Santa Maria Novella, which means the water of Santa Maria Novella. And it's basically a strong distillate of peppermint. It's peppermint spirits in water. And this stuff is, you know, we got a couple big bottles of it, but I've since learned to reproduce it and make it myself. It's really easy to do. And it was used for, you know, bloating and spasm in the belly, but it was also primarily used for what they would call hysteria, or, you know, frazzledness, out-of-controlledness, anxiety, because, again, it would help get us out of that state of fear or fight or flight and bring us into a more relaxed, even place, both through its smell as we absorb it in, through our nose and into our brain, but also through the internal effect of volatile oils on the internal organs and on the cardiovascular system. Mm-hmm. Now, the other neat thing that I found about the water of Santa Maria Novella is if you take it a little bit first thing in the morning, it actually wakes you up. And that brings it back to the sort of amazing double effect, or sometimes opposite switch-hitting effect that aromatics plants can have on our spirits. If we feel out of it or tired or depressed or sluggish, ginger tea or peppermint water from this alchemical pharmacy in Florence, or one that you make yourself, it's going to wake you up. It's going to get things going. You're going to feel more of a zing and more of a burst of inspiration. But conversely, if you feel too tight or frazzled or anxious, it'll have the opposite effect because of the relaxing quality of the volatiles. And that really, you know, when you get down to it, and having done the research on this, it's because these aromatic chemicals, the volatile oils, have a two-phase effect on the smooth muscle of the body, stimulating it at first and then deeply relaxing it.
Yes. I wanted to ask you a question about bitters. Do you think we owe our knowledge of bitters to a paranoid, power-hungry, poison-making monarch from long ago and far away?
Well, I really think that those guys, Mithridates, the crazy, paranoid, obsessed king who was always freaking out that someone was going to poison him, and rightly so, you know, if you read his story, and his herbalist, Cretuus or Critias, I think that they gave us the first sort of recipe for an actual medicinal bitter tonic. But they've been part of traditional cultures forever. And in fact, chimpanzees use bitter herbs when they feel like their belly is upset. So I think we were herbalists who used bitter plants before we were even human.
Very good. So with tonics, this section can almost begin and end with your quote from Henry David Thoreau, "We need the tonic of wilderness," or wildness, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it can. And, you know, that's, again, what folks like Richard Louv are saying, and a growing chorus of people who echo his sentiment that the more high-tech we become, the more nature we need, right? And Thoreau recognized this a long time ago, and that's why he holed up on Walden Pond and tried to get away from the quote-unquote bustle, right, of colonial America. But, you know, if you plopped Thoreau down in the middle of New York City today, I don't know exactly what he would think. He'd probably run for the hills as fast as he could. Not to say that there's anything wrong with New York City. It's an awesome place, and I love the technology, and I love the media, and I love the intensity of that thriving human establishment, right? But the more high-tech we become, the more nature we need. We need this tonic of wildness. And we don't just need to be out in it. It needs to be in us, too. And you can get a lot by going and walking out in the forest. And you know, there's this Japanese practice of forest bathing, Shinrin-yoku, that's receiving a lot of attention and I think is fantastic. But communing, you know, with these plants, with nature, by taking these wild plants internally, does so much more than just being out in the natural space. These plants are unhybridized. We haven't messed with them the way we've messed with our grains or with our tomatoes. They're the same way they were 100,000 years ago. They sit and breathe the same air and drink the same water and eat the same soil that we walk on and experience every day. So they actually are tuned to the changes in the environment in a way that is much more subtle and penetrating than we are. But if we eat them, we can get tuned because they change the chemistry that they elaborate based on environmental conditions. We can also get the benefit of their attention to the environment. And the final part of it is, you know, it's not just medicinally helpful from a, you know, individual perspective. You know, certainly taking reishi mushroom as a tonic is going to help me with my allergy symptoms. It's going to help me prevent cancer. Eating yarrow as a bitter tonic is going to help my gut. But it also helps our culture, and it helps our children, and hopefully will allow us to continue along this sort of dizzying escalation of progress and technological advancement and stay sustainable. Because when people start to experience wildness internally, you know, their mind starts to change. We've seen this from experiencing wildness externally. You know, it started the whole national park movement. These places are amazing. We need to keep them for posterity. It's really important. But I think the flip side is like paying attention to our internal environment. We need these wild plants inside us, too. And if you do that, it's kind of a way to take the best of the natural world around you and outside you and bring it back into your city, right? So Thoreau doesn't have to run for the hills. Yes. Thoreau can bring some of those plants from the hills into his, you know, Fifth Avenue penthouse, or who the heck knows where he would live these days.
Right.
And get benefit from it.
Yes, Guido, I have one more question for you. Do the spiritual powers of plants beg the question for you, which came first, the plant power or the human empowering the plant? I know you're a mystic at heart here.
The human empowering the plant, what exactly do you mean by that? You mean us giving the plant power because of the powerful effects that it has on us?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I think that that's really at the heart of it, Robin. You know, the human would not be the human without the plant, I think, is ultimately the point. So we sort of raise these plants up and say, wow, hawthorn is an amazing medicine for the heart. But it's not like we stumbled on hawthorn 5 years ago and we're like, okay, let's run it through some clinical trials and see how it does. No, our heart and cardiovascular system grew up in the context of consuming hawthorn berry and other berries, it kind of needs them in order to be itself, if you know what I mean. It's kind of like a fish out of water. It's a human out of the forest without it. And we can handle being outside of the forest, but we can't handle not having this biodiversity internally. I mean, we can't necessarily handle never going to the forest, but we can make it in a city, I think, as long as we have this biodiversity internally. And that's, I think, ultimately the crux of it. These plants have power not because we give them power, but because they created us. Our system is built upon a context that is botanical. We were insects at one time, and a lot of these plant chemicals were toxic to us, so we evolved a liver. And now they're not. But our liver doesn't know what to do if it doesn't experience these things.
Yes.
Because it's built to have them on a daily basis.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that realization is the mystical realization, ultimately, that we are so inextricably entwined with this green world that when we remove ourselves from it, we start to see mental health issues, cardiovascular issues, rising cancer, difficulty relating to our food, and an increase in symptoms of toxicity. But it's because we've turned our backs on these allies, these lovers, these parents, really, which are the plants of the green world that are wild and unhybridized, plants that we have had every single day in big quantities since before we were human beings. But I think that realization, ultimately, is an incredibly profound medicine in and of itself. Because it makes us realize, like, listen, it doesn't matter how smart we are and how great our technology is. We are messy, organic wetware, and we need to be in the right operating environment. And that operating environment includes wild plants.
A little education about the aromatic, bitter, and tonic plants, and we can take it a long way, folks. Guido Massé's book is The Wild Medicine Solution. And he teaches at the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for our weekly notification of shows, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting, it's iTunes Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.